As a church, we serve Iraqi refugees, Syrian refugees, and not all of them living in camps. Some of them choose to be out of the camp because camps, it's not freedom. Most of the families, they have from 5 to 20 kids. They are living in one room, all of them. They need food, medicine, healthcare.
They're struggling to finish their education. If they don't go to school, it will be very hard for them to survive.
If these kids, they were raised on streets with bitterness, with bad memory, what future we will have?
In Syria, I was a lab technician. But here, I had to learn sewing because it was the only way I could provide for my children. Our future will be difficult. We don't have anyone here. The only real family we found was the church.
This church has hope for many people in this environment. When they are sick, they are coming to the church. When they are in need, they are coming to the church. We are trying to serve more than 1,000 kids. Most of them, they are not Christian background. The hard part with the kids, you cannot see fast story. You need time. We invest in their life and we see the difference after 3, 4, 5 years. When we start our ministry with refugees, they start to ask, why? Why you help us? Why you support? Why you love us? I believe a lot of people, they are, you know, outside without hope, without love, without care. To invest in this kind of people, it's great investment. They are the present and future. And if we invest in their life, we will see a good future.
The church gave us the most help in the way they care for us, in their love for us. They give us food. They gave my children clothes, and now they are able to get an education. It's become impossible for us not to go to church because they have become our family.
Today I met some kids. I asked them, what's the good thing you see today? They said, Jesus. I said, how? They said, the story of Jesus today touched our heart.
When I look at this generation, I see them, we call them the Joshua generation. They are the generation that they will live all the promises. God has given this generation an opportunity to know him. And actually, the real opportunity is for the church.
When Jesus died on the cross, not just to come to the church and worship God Sunday and back to our normal life. We are here to show the real love for those that are in need. And this is my hope. If the church raised a new generation with a message, with a hope, with love, I believe this is our time to restore the Middle East.
Well, I really like to start with that video, mostly for a line that I don't know if you caught it from Clara, the pastor's wife. She said, the real opportunity is for the church. And that's very much, for me personally, for World Relief, where I work, our view as we think about a particular issue that I think is an issue of justice, which is refugees and migration, that it's easy to think about these topics as a threat, as a problem, as a crisis even. And there's some element. There are some problems. There is a dynamic of crisis, but there's also an opportunity. And that's, if you, you know, snoozed right now and get nothing else, I hope that you heard that. And so I'd like to start with that video for that reason. It expresses it so beautifully in a global context in the Middle East, but the same is true in the United States. It's also a really good introduction to sort of our ministry philosophy at World Relief, where I have the privilege of working. World Relief was actually started out of a migration crisis in the days after World War II. When it was probably the last greatest forced migration crisis in our world. It was a church in Boston, Park Street Church, decided that they were gonna take some particular days to encourage their congregation to fast and pray for the situation, and they take the funds that they would have spent on the meal and work with other churches and the National Association of Evangelicals, which had just been launched at that point, and send the funds over to churches in Europe to help rebuild Europe and to help the refugees and displaced people there. And then a few decades later, as the vision for world relief went beyond Europe to the rest of the world, we were serving refugees in Southeast Asia in the days after the Vietnam War. And then there was a missionary couple who we'd partnered with there who had been serving in Vietnam and come back to the States, and they started to get letters and telegraphs from people from the churches in Vietnam that they'd helped to start that were basically saying, is there anything you can do to help us? We've had to flee our country. We're in Singapore. We're in various other places. Can you help us? So this was a very creative couple. They started knocking on doors and basically found the opportunity with the U.S. government to start resettling refugees in the United States. And when they ran out of local churches within their own denomination, they said, maybe we could work with World Relief and you guys can help us reach a broader range of Christian churches throughout the United States. And that was how in 1979 we became one of what's now 9 agencies nationally that resettles refugees throughout the U.S. Most closely here, we're up in the Oshkosh-Appleton area where I grew up. Unfortunately, not right here in Madison. But that's a core part of our ministry, is serving refugees. And other immigrants as well, people who didn't come as refugees but who have come fleeing perhaps poverty or for other reasons. But as you're all probably fairly aware, this topic of refugees, immigration, is a little bit controversial right now. It's maybe always been somewhat controversial, but I don't think, at least in the 10 years I've been at World Relief, I've never seen it at quite the fever pitch that we see right now. I think the day that, if there was one day on the calendar that made that true, it probably was just about 2 years ago when I opened my phone one day and saw this image in my Facebook feed, and some of you saw it in the news or in the newspaper, of a little boy washed ashore on a beach in Turkey, Alan Kurdi, 3 years old, looks kind of like he's sleeping, but he's not sleeping. He passed away in an unsuccessful attempt to reach safety from the Syrian civil war and by reaching Europe. And that picture somehow grabbed the attention of the world in a way that the Syrian civil war that had been already happening for 4 or 5 years hadn't. And suddenly people were feeling, I think, competing emotions. On the one hand, I don't think anyone sees that picture and doesn't feel compassion. I mean, I look at it and it looks like my 2-year-old son, who wears similar little Velcro shoes. And I can't help but grieve for that family. But it's only a half second later, and even subconsciously in my mind, and I start to feel another emotion, which is one of fear. Because I start to think, what on earth are they running away from that father thought that getting in that boat was the best decision? What is behind them? What kind of terror and horror, and how do we keep that from coming here to my 2-year-old son? And you have these competing emotions of compassion on one hand and fear on another. And I think very often those emotions, not even just dividing, you know, red states and blue states, but right down the heart of most of us are what divide our thinking on some of these topics. And we've seen a measurable increase in the level of fear, particularly around refugees, but around migration issues more generally as well. So because our mission at World Relief isn't just to help resettle refugees and serve immigrants, but to empower local churches to do so, the way you saw in the film, we do the same thing in the U.S. context. About towards the end of 2015, the beginning of 2016, we began to wonder, you know, this issue of refugees, which we've been working at for decades, suddenly is in the news all the time. Suddenly it's something that people have very strong opinions about. People who probably couldn't have told you what a refugee was 3 or 4 years ago suddenly have very strong opinions on all sides. And we began to be a little bit nervous. We wondered, you know, our mission is to empower the church. Are churches going to want to work with us, or are they going to be pulling back and saying, you know, we don't want to touch that very controversial topic? So we actually commissioned some research. I'm going to share with you a few of the results of this research. We worked with a polling firm that's a Christian polling firm, Lifeway Research, and we polled Protestant pastors in the United States. The first thing we found was actually very encouraging to me. We found that 86% of Protestant pastors in the U.S. said that as Christians, as followers of Jesus, we have a responsibility to care sacrificially for refugees and other foreigners. Now, I'd like to get that up to 100% because I feel this is really important, but 86%, like that's, we can work with that. That's pretty good. The next finding was a lot less encouraging. 8% of pastors said that someone in their local church was currently involved in serving refugees in their community. Another roughly 1 in 5 said, well, our church has something to do with serving refugees outside of the United States. So there's obviously a pretty large gap between the roughly 9 in 10 who say we should do something and the maybe 1 in 5 who in any way are doing something. And of course, I naturally then begin to wonder what accounts for that gap. Why this chasm between our theology, what we believe is right and true based on the way we read scripture, at least at a pastoral level. I don't know if you get the same results of if you pulled the pews, but our theology on one side and our praxis, how we live that out. And I suspect that there's a lot of reasons for that. Refugees aren't resettled into every community where they are resettled. The resettlement agencies, including World Relief, have certainly not done a perfect job of reaching out to churches and saying, here's opportunities for you to be involved. But I think that a big part of it does go back to that fear that people feel and that's felt within local churches just as it is in the larger society. There's plenty of good, right, biblical things we can do, and not all of them will get you a bunch of angry emails if you mention them on Sunday morning, because this is a tough topic. We've been able to quantify a little bit of that as well. This was a separate survey we did about a year earlier of people who describe themselves as evangelical Christians, so not pastors, but lay people. 57% of evangelical Christians in the United States, 69% of white evangelicals, if you look just at my category of evangelical, say that the arrival of immigrants to their community presents some sort of a threat or a burden. Now, what was discouraging to me was only 42% said, well, the arrival of immigrants presents an opportunity to introduce them to Jesus. Now, this wasn't choose one or the other. This was check all that apply. So even if you think immigrants are stealing jobs or refugees are potential terrorists, you could still say, but there is an opportunity to introduce people to Jesus. And this is evangelical Christians who are people kind of by definition who want to introduce people to Jesus. But most self-professed evangelical Christians don't see that as an opportunity as it relates to immigration. And I think that that is probably a function of the fact that our human brains have a hard time with complexity. It's hard for us to see an opportunity when we've fixated on what we've perceived to be a threat. And here's the other challenge. Our survey also found that only 12% of evangelical Christians in the United States say that their views on immigration issues are primarily influenced by the Bible. Again, evangelical Christians are people who would say the Bible is is their top influence on everything. It should be the lens through which we view all of life. But by our own admission, it's not usually what's forming our views on the arrival of immigrants. In fact, what the Bible says, the views of national Christian leaders, and the teaching of my local church, those three categories combined, were mentioned less often than the media. And this is with what surveys will tell you is a halo effect. The halo effect in surveys is basically people tend to give the right answer. So if you're an evangelical Christian and the Bible was one of the choices, it's probably the right answer, right? Like, the Bible, Jesus, Sunday school, like any of those boxes are good ones to check. But most people were apparently honest and said, no, it's the media, or it's things I read on the internet, or it's a personal relationship I have. Those are not all bad things. They're important. Of course, those are going to influence our views. But our view is that what should be the primary influence on our views on this topic, and on every topic, is what God's word has to say. Especially because this is a topic that actually God's word has a lot to say on. So I'm going to spend most of my time this morning really just looking at what does the Bible have to say. Those of you who want to go deeper on this, we'll look a little bit more at some of the facts and figures around this in the workshop that I'll be leading. This morning I'm just going to focus on what the Bible says for the most part. The first biblical theme that I wanted to start with is that Jesus himself was a refugee. Last Christmas time, my daughter Zipporah, who's now 4, she's a very bright 4-year-old. I suppose all parents think that, but very smart. But she got really excited about our little wooden nativity set, which I think we got as like a wedding present or something, but we took that out in November, and for the whole month of December, it was Zipporah's favorite toy. And she's read the Jesus Storybook Bible enough to know the story of the nativity of, you know, the wise men and Mary and Joseph going to Bethlehem and then the shepherds, and she knows the whole story, and she gets to act it out with her little wooden characters. But she made this very important observation. She said, hey, Dad, we're missing a figurine in our nativity set. We don't have a mean king. I started to think about that. Do any of you have a nativity set with a King Herod figurine? not necessarily our favorite part of the story, right? Like, I've been to enough Christmas pageants that end with the wise men bowing down before the baby Jesus, and then the curtain comes down and we all go home and have Christmas dinner. Rarely do we spend a lot of time thinking about this evil, paranoid, tyrannical Middle Eastern king who's coming to kill in a genocide all the little baby boys in Bethlehem. Maybe not what you want for the Christmas Eve service, I don't know. But it's part of the story in Matthew chapter 2. As soon as the wise men were back on their way into their country, Joseph is warned in a dream that Herod is coming. He's going to kill all the baby boys. And so Joseph is told to get up in the middle of the night, take Mary, take baby Jesus, and escape to Egypt. And we don't know what the journey was like exactly. We can speculate a little bit because it was a long journey and it wasn't in an air-conditioned vehicle. It's also interesting to speculate, how were they treated when they got to Egypt? It's fairly likely that there was some sort of a Jewish diaspora already living there who might have welcomed them, had some unique compassion for them. But it's also quite possible that there was people who didn't want these strangers coming into their land. We don't know if Joseph got asked, hey, you know what, Joseph, we've got enough carpenters in this economy without you taking a job. Or if Jesus was suspected of carrying some sort of disease, and for that reason other families wouldn't want their children around him. What we do know pretty clearly is that Jesus, in his humanity, can very personally identify with the roughly 65 million people in our world today who've been forcibly displaced, who, because of a threat of persecution, have had to leave their countries of origin, or have been displaced within their own country. Another biblical theme that relates to the topic of migration is just the biblical teaching that every human person is made in the image and likeness of God. We find that back in the very beginning of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1. And what that means is that every person, regardless of any qualifier, regardless of their country of origin or their gender or their religion or their ethnicity or anything else, has inherent human dignity, that their lives are worth protecting. And not only dignity, but also potential, because they are made in the image of the Creator God. We are then made to be creative. And I think we sometimes make the mistake when we talk about immigration of just looking at, well, what are those immigrants going to take? You know, how many jobs are they going to take? Or what kind of governmental services are they going to take? Which are fair questions. But we make a mistake if we don't also ask the question, what are they going to contribute? Because they are human beings made in the image of God, just like every one of us. Have any of you ever heard the name Sergey Brin? I see one or two hands up. So there's, you know, it's not necessarily a household name. Sergey Brin came to this country as a refugee, as a kid, fleeing with his family, anti-Semitic persecution in the former Soviet Union. Went to school here, started a small business. Actually, immigrants are, if you look at some of the data, uniquely entrepreneurial, even compared to U.S. citizens. His small business went big. In fact, it is by one measure the biggest company in the world right now. It's called Google. And you've probably all heard of Google. I used it to get here this morning. It's got this great thing. It lives in my pocket. It's amazing. I don't know how it works, but answers all my questions. Also employs tens of thousands of people. So we can ask, well, how many jobs was Sergey Brin going to take? But we might also want to ask how many he might create. And I can't promise you that the Burmese refugee landing at the Madison Airport this morning is going to create the next largest company in the world, but she might. That's how potential works. I think that's particularly relevant. One of the things that's been in the news a lot lately is the situation of roughly 700,000 to 800,000 young people who our government gave work permission to, starting around 2012, through this program called DACA, and is now set to take that away. And there's a lot of reasons that issue is close to my heart. I know people who are directly impacted by that. But just on a national interest level, I think about what a loss of potential when you have people whom our country has educated, at least through high school, who want to contribute, who are currently contributing, who are currently paying taxes, and now we're going to say you can't work lawfully. You can't then pay your taxes. You can't contribute. To me, that seems like such a loss and a short-sighted view of who people are. Another biblical theme, and this goes to the idea of justice, is that God has a particular concern for those who are the most vulnerable to injustice. And there's three groups of people who we find mentioned over and over and over again in the Old Testament. It's the orphan, the widow, and the foreigner. Or depending upon your translation to English, the sojourner, the stranger, the alien, the immigrant, Tim Keller in Generous Justice, which you now got, a fourth plug for, makes a really good argument that the Hebrew word that we find most of the time for a foreigner, it's the word ger, should really be translated as an immigrant. It's a foreigner residing in a different country. So not a tourist, that's maybe a distinction, but an immigrant. And that word, the ger in the Hebrew, appears 92 times in the Old Testament. This is not one or two verses that we might have missed somewhere. It's actually a very frequent theme as you read, especially through the Old Testament. And again, very often, the immigrant is right alongside the orphan and the widow as people whom God declares very specifically whom he loves, for whom he will establish justice, but also whom he commands his people to love and to seek justice for. Even to the point of establishing laws in the Old Testament in the Torah that said, you know, when you're going through your crops, your grapes, your olives, your grain, you should go through everything one time, and then you leave what remains for the orphan, the widow, and the immigrant. So it wasn't there was a means by which these vulnerable groups of people could have their basic human needs provided for. They still had to go to work. They still had to go to the fields. But that these uniquely vulnerable people who didn't have land, who didn't have family to help provide for them in most cases, could have their needs provided for. And you see that come alive if you read the story of Ruth, where Ruth comes as a foreigner into the land of Israel. And where does she go? She goes to glean in the fields. And I don't know if she was entitled to a double portion because she was both a widow and an immigrant, but that was how the law was supposed to work. It explains a few things when you read the story and you're like, well, that's kind of weird. You know, what's she doing? That was the system that God had set up. Another biblical command is the command to love our neighbors as ourselves. And we find that for the first time in the Old Testament in Leviticus chapter 19. God tells the Israelites, you shall love your neighbors yourself. And then just a few verses later in chapter 19, verse 34, almost as if anticipating a very natural human inclination to want to narrowly define who our neighbor is, God tells the Israelites, when foreigners reside with you in your land, you shall not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you shall be to you as your native born. You shall love them as yourselves. And then he reminds them, for you were foreigners in the land of Egypt. So even just from the Old Testament, we have this idea that the neighbor whom we're commanded to love is defined broadly. But Jesus makes that all the more clear in the New Testament when he's asked in Luke chapter 10 by a lawyer, a legal scholar, who comes and says, well, what's the greatest commandment? Jesus says it's to love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And then he's a lawyer, so like a good lawyer, he's got a follow-up question. He wants a precise legal definition. Who is my neighbor? And it says in the text that he wanted to justify himself. So we can presume he wanted the response to be a carefully defined, you know, your neighbor is someone who lives three doors down on either side as long as they speak the same language and have the same ethnicity as you. And I suppose if that was the definition, then if you didn't like your neighbor, which is going to make it really hard to love them, you could move. But that's not the definition that Jesus gives us of a neighbor. You all know the story, I expect, of the Good Samaritan, which is how Jesus responds. He tells a story of this guy going down the road to Jericho who's beaten and robbed and left basically for dead. And a priest and a Levite, the religious leaders of the time, come by, passed on by on the other side. But a Samaritan, someone of a different ethnic group, someone whose theology actually was not quite all correct, comes by, sees this person in need, and has compassion on them. He gets down, he takes them to get help. And I think the takeaway for us is that our neighbor might be someone of a different religious group, might be someone of a different ethnic group. There's really no qualifier that we need to know when someone is in need for us to know that we are commanded to show love to them. Another observation I think is important to note is that, you know, I spend a lot of my time, and we'll talk about this in my workshop for those of you who want to be a part of it, looking at sort of the stats on the relative safety of welcoming refugees or welcoming immigrants to the United States. I think it's quite safe. I'll say that. But even if it wasn't safe for the Good Samaritan to get down off of his donkey on a dangerous part of the road where people get robbed and beaten. The safe, you know, seemingly prudent thing to do might have been to walk on by on the other side, don't make eye contact, get out of that situation. Or we ask, people have a lot of questions about the economics of this. And again, I think there's a strong case economically for welcoming immigrants. But even if there wasn't, it wasn't in his economic interest to stop and to take from his own money to pay to have for this injured man's needs to be met. But it's the example Jesus gives us of loving our neighbor, and then he says to him, and I think to all of us, go and do likewise. Now, some people hear this talk and they'll be thinking, you know, that's great for immigrants. Refugees have legal status. If you didn't know that, now you do. Refugees come to this country with legal status. But what about immigrants who aren't here legally? Because doesn't the Bible say some things about obeying the law as well? And yes, it does. In Romans chapter 13, at least, we're commanded to be subject to the governing authorities. Now, that might be more nuanced than just obey the law under all circumstances. I think we could all think of circumstances, even biblically, when, for example, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are told to worship an idol, where obeying the law would not have been the right, just decision. But we are commanded to be subject to governing authorities. God has established governments, and we are to be a part of those systems. The law is actually a really good thing, and it maintains order. God has established that. So what do we do then? We're commanded to love and welcome immigrants. What do we do when some of them are not here legally? Now, it is important to note that I think a lot of people hear the word immigrant, and they immediately associate that word with the word illegal. Well, more than 70% of the immigrants in our country have legal status, either as naturalized citizens or as someone with a green card. So it's not actually a fair association. But it is true that roughly 11 million people in our country are undocumented, meaning they have either entered the country unlawfully or about half the time they overstayed a visa that was a valid temporary visa but it expired. And frankly, in a college town like Madison, it's probably weighted towards the latter because you've probably got a good number of student visa overstayers. But what do we do with that dynamic? I think one thing that gets lost in this is if we're going to be serious about being subject to the governing authorities, we don't just read Romans 13 and say, close the Bible, we shouldn't go near immigrants. We say, well, what did the governing authorities say on this matter? And the good news is that if you happen to be a U.S. citizen, it's actually pretty difficult for you to violate U.S. immigration law. There's one big way you could do so, and that's employing someone. That's pretty clearly black and white against the law if they are not authorized to work. But for you to welcome them to your church, to teach them Sunday school, to let them teach Sunday school to you, so long as there's no compensation involved, to have an English class or a food pantry or any sort of ministry that a church might do or an individual might do, just being kind to their neighbors is not unlawful. There's no legal expectation that you would report someone who you suspect might not be here unlawfully, which I can also tell you, as someone with an immigration legal background is not something you can see by looking at someone. Immigration law is incredibly complex, and it's not something that you can just suspect that this person might not have legal status. Now, this is a more complicated issue for our brothers and sisters in Christ who are themselves here unlawfully. And I've known a number of young people who are part of local churches who've really wrestled with this. I think of one person, he's a Baptist. He was in the neighborhood where I lived for about 8 years. He came from Mexico more than 20 years ago with his wife and two kids at a point of economic desperation. Wasn't a believer when he came here. But at some point after arriving in the United States, he became a Christian. Someone shared the gospel with him. And he was all in. He started reading his Bible. He ended up going to Bible school. He knows the scriptures just as well as I do. He knows what Romans 13 says. And he's actually deeply troubled by it because he wants to get right with the law. So his first response, of course, is to try to do so. He's talked to lawyers. He's talked to our legal counselors at World Relief. And we've all had to tell him the same thing, which is for someone in your circumstance, there's no way to go back and come the legal way. You can go back to Mexico, that's certainly possible. You can't come back legally, not in a year, not in 5 years, not in 10 years, not if you have the best attorney in the country, maybe if you had $1 million to invest in an investor visa, but he doesn't. But for most people in that circumstance, there's actually no possibility of getting right with the law, which is what he would desperately like to do. So he's considered going back to Mexico. But that's a complicated decision because, for one thing, he's had three more children in this country who are U.S. citizens who've never been to Mexico. And they're teenagers now. The youngest is in high school. If he would go back, frankly, they'd rather stay and go move in with their cousins and finish high school and go on to college, which has been their plan. But he thinks that he's been called by God to be their father. And even just at the level of his marriage, his wife isn't feeling quite the same conviction on this that he is. I mean, she's a believer as well, but what do you do when she's not going? But you want to keep your marriage together. And then just on a biblical level, he'd point me to a passage like 1 Timothy 5, where we're told that if anyone does not provide for his family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Strong words from the Apostle Paul. Well, that's why he came in the first place, was to provide for his family, even as a non-Christian, out of this sense that he was called to provide for his family. He couldn't make ends meet where he was, So we made a tough decision to move. So he asked me, Matt, what should I do? And honestly, I don't know the right advice to give him in every case. I think these cases are complicated. I think it's more complicated than what part of illegal don't you understand? It's also what part of provide for your family don't you understand? And what I would love to be able to tell my friend is, you know what, here's the process you need to go through to make this right. He's not looking for amnesty that says you broke the law, it's forgiven and forgotten, here's your citizenship. He'd be willing to do just about anything. In fact, he has paid lots of money to attorneys who turned out to not be attorneys to try to make it right. And it's not possible under current law without some changes to the law itself. Another biblical theme, and it relates to that neighbor of mine in the Chicago area and to many others, is that the church, according to the Apostle Paul, is one body. It's made up of many distinct, different, but interdependent parts. So the hand can't say to the foot, I don't need you. The eye can't say to the mouth, I don't need you. I think it's a fair extrapolation that the mostly white church can't say to the mostly Latino church, I don't need you. And the Korean church can't say to the black church, I don't need you, and vice versa. Every part needs every other part. I think sometimes, though, what happens in the U.S., especially among evangelicals like me, is not so much that one part of the body is explicitly saying to another part, we don't want you, we don't need you. Sometimes one part of the body doesn't know the other part exists. But if you look at the data on this on a national level, particularly among evangelical Christians, so this would be true in the Catholic Church or the mainline Protestant traditions as well, evangelicalism in the United States is growing in total numbers, slightly, almost entirely because of immigrants and their children. If you look just at white evangelicalism, it's on a fairly significant decline. But it is growing largely because of immigrants and their children. In fact, just between 2007 and 2014, the Pew Research Center did a really interesting study. The percentage of American evangelicals who were non-white, who are not all immigrants, but that's a significant part of it, went from 19% to 24% in 7 years. That's a fairly remarkable growth trajectory, and the largest growth there happened among Latinos, again, who are not all immigrants, many of them, in fact, most of them are born in the United States, or might come from Puerto Rico, which is a territory of U.S. citizens, but many of them are immigrants from Mexico or Central or South America, or their children. But we're told in Scripture that when one part of the body suffers, every part suffers with it. And if you don't know the suffering that happens in immigrant communities when there are dysfunctional policies, it's probably because you don't know any immigrants. When you do know immigrants, you'll start to understand what it means when a father dies and you can't travel back to be with them before they die or to be at the funeral because you wouldn't be able to get back in. Or what it means when a father's deported and mom is left with 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 kids struggling to survive, making the decision, do we all go back to this country that the kids don't even know? But it was, you know, the economic situation hasn't gotten better there. We could probably provide for the whole family if we stay here, but we live separated. For those young people who've been granted the hope of work permission through the DACA program who now have that going away, who are facing the reality of going back into the shadows or even being deported to a country that some of them don't know. The pain is very real. The fears are very real. And it's the calling of the church for all of us to share that. Another biblical theme that I think relates especially to refugees, and let me, a little definition. A refugee is an immigrant. There's someone from country residing in another, but specifically defined by the circumstances of why they left. Under U.S. and international law, refugee is someone who has fled persecution on account of their race, their religion, their political opinion, their national origin, or their social group. And that one of those five categories under the law is religion. I think what often gets missed in some of the media coverage around refugees is that one of the religions that often leads to people being persecuted is Christianity. It's followers of Jesus, brothers and sisters in Christ in other parts of the world who, because they insist on following Jesus, are at risk of losing their lives or their livelihoods. And when I say persecution, I'm not talking about it the way sometimes we might use that word in the United States. I'm not talking about your Starbucks cup doesn't say Merry Christmas. We're talking about people who were at risk of losing their entire lives. I think it's missed sometimes with all the focus on refugees coming to the United States that over the past 10 years, there's been more Christians who've come to the U.S. as refugees than those of any other faith background. The number one country of origin for refugees to the United States in the last decade has been Burma or Myanmar in Southeast Asia. 70% of them are Christians, primarily Baptists or Anglicans. Coming from a context where a very small percentage of the overall population are Christians, and the government is very, very harsh towards Christians and towards other religious minorities. We're seeing that in the news now with the Rohingya, who are Muslims, which is also not the majority religion of Burma. But as those brothers and sisters in Christ are persecuted, forced to flee their country, a small percentage of them end up in our country. And we have the opportunity to be there at the airport to welcome them and to help them rebuild their lives and to help grieve with them what has been lost. I just put myself, if I can, I try to think of if I were in their situation. If I were forced with my wife and kids to flee the United States and ended up at some airport halfway across the world with a language I didn't speak and a culture that was totally foreign to me, I would be so grateful if there would be someone from a local church who would be there to welcome me. And we have that opportunity for brothers and sisters who experience persecution beyond what most of us can comprehend. And when we do so, there's a sense in which we're actually welcoming Jesus himself. In Matthew 25, Jesus said, I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. Of course, the flip side to a lot of refugees being Christians is that a lot of refugees are not Christians. And I think if we're honest, that's why this issue has become so controversial, right? Like, if it was all Christians fleeing Burma or Congo or Ukraine, I'm not sure it'd make the news. We've had a really hard time getting our Ukrainian and Burmese and Congolese refugee Christians into the news because it's always about the Middle East. That's the story that we tend to hear about. And a lot of people see that as a threat. But my view and our view at World Relief is actually it's a remarkable opportunity. You know, I grew up in a church where we prayed on a regular basis for the 1040 window, this part of the world where very few people are followers of Jesus. And I think that God has answered our prayers by sending people from those parts of the world to us. And it's an opportunity to fulfill the Great Commission, to make disciples of all nations right in our own communities. Very often that happens in response to a question. 1 Peter 3 tells us to be ready to give an answer for the hope that's within us, to do so with gentleness and respect. And to be really clear, at World Relief, we make a really clear distinction between proselytism, which is any sort of a hard sell. We're going to trick you into converting into be a Christian, or we're going to serve you better if you do. We serve people the same regardless of their faith background. But we do believe in evangelism, rightly understood, which is being a witness to who Jesus is. And it's rare, frankly, when it's a team from a church that meets a family at the airport and then becomes their best friends in this country, that as language develops, sooner or later isn't going to ask the question, wait, why were you there to help us? How much is your government paying you to do this? And we say, no, we're volunteers. We do this because we love you. We do this because we love Jesus. And we get to point people to a relationship with the Lord. I'm going to jump ahead to one last point, one last biblical story. And I will say, for those of you who are thinking, but you didn't tell us what to do, what's an application here? We'll go through more of that in our workshop, so I hope you'll join us for that. I'm going to close with one last biblical theme, and that's the idea of hospitality. Hospitality, it's kind of a good church word, right? I don't know if you have like a hospitality committee around here, but usually it means something like the people who make the coffee on Sunday morning, which is really important to me. Or we use that word to say, basically to have our friends or our extended family over. Like my wife and I had some friends over for dinner just a few nights ago, and as they're putting their shoes on the way out the door, they said, thanks so much for your hospitality. Which is great. I'm all for having your friends over for dinner. But it's actually not hospitality in the biblical sense of the word. Because biblically, hospitality is philoxenia. It is the love of strangers, which is a countercultural idea. I mean, I grew up watching Saturday morning cartoons about stranger danger, right? Like, strangers are scary people. Strangers are people who are a potential threat to you. Stay away from them. And I get why we send that message to children, but I think maybe sometimes as adults, sometimes even as a society, our response to those who are different from us, who are unknown to us, is to first see a potential threat, kind of hunch up our shoulders. Don't make eye contact. But the biblical command is, Romans 12, practice hospitality. Practice loving strangers. And it doesn't come with this promise that they're always safe. Again, we can go through the stats on the security of immigrants or refugees, but I'm not going to tell you it's always safe. But I can tell you in Hebrews chapter 13 that we are told that some people, by welcoming strangers, by practicing hospitality, have actually welcomed angels without realizing it. Which suggests that immigrants, refugees, could actually be a blessing. I'll close with this story. About 5 or 6 years ago, my wife and I lived for a number of years in this apartment complex outside of Chicago where most of our neighbors were refugees and other immigrants. And there was a new family that moved in. They're from East Africa. Mom, 8 months pregnant with 3 other kids. And they didn't come as refugees, which means that World Relief, we didn't know they were coming. We didn't pick them up at the airport with a church team. They just kind of showed up on their own on a tourist visa. But they were actually like refugees in that they were fleeing persecution. And they applied for asylum once they got to the United States. But they didn't, because they didn't come through World Relief, nobody really knew they were there. And as we got to know them, my wife speaks French really well, which is like their fourth language, so she could communicate with them. We discovered pretty quickly that they didn't know anyone. They had almost nothing. They have this one-bedroom apartment with no furniture in it and an eight-month-old pregnant lady. So we put up a message on Facebook, and we wanted to practice hospitality, right? We wanted to show love for these strangers. We put up a message on Facebook. Some folks from our church brought some air mattresses and some couches, and my wife was there at the hospital when that baby was born. We helped the kids get into school. Eventually, their asylum application was approved, which is not an easy thing, so that in itself was kind of an answer to prayer. And then the mom got a job. Even the high school-aged daughter got a job. Their son was in a Bible study that I lead, and I got to be there as he was baptized at our church. And after a year or so, they didn't need a lot of help. They're actually doing pretty well, and they were just our friends, which is actually the trajectory that we hope for at World Relief, that people go from being strangers to neighbors to family. And then after about 2 years after they first arrived, their husband/father showed up. And it's a long story why he wasn't there at the beginning, goes to the persecution they were running away from. But I was there at O'Hare Airport when he met his two-year-old daughter for the first time in the baggage claim. And I was just a weepy mess. You know, everyone else was holding it together quite well, and I'm just like, don't mind me, because I was just, you know, I couldn't keep my emotions in check. It was powerful to see him with his daughter for the first time. And he became a dear friend as well. Over the course of time, both of them really became good friends to us, in some ways became mentors to my wife Diana and me in marriage, because they've been at that for a lot longer than us. And at one point, they asked us a question, and this is like not culturally appropriate, but we'll forgive it because they're not from here. They were over at our house for dinner, and they said, so you guys have been married for a little while now. When are you going to have kids? And Diana and I kind of looked at each other like, how much do we want to go into this? The reality is we'd been hoping and praying to have kids for more than a year at that point, and it hadn't happened. And we didn't know the reasons it wasn't happening. We hadn't gotten that far, but it was definitely a sensitive topic. So we kind of explained that and said, yeah, we'd really appreciate your prayers, which is the sort of thing that Christians say. Of course, we'd been praying. You know, we'd been praying that God would bless us with a child. But I remember Jean Vier told me, I just have this sense from the Lord that he's going to bless you with a child in the next year. And we're going to be praying for you. And we thanked him. But I didn't go start painting the nursery because, you know, it's not like I hadn't tried prayer. But it was only a few months later. We were over at their house for dinner this time. And we got to share with them the good news that my wife, Diana, was pregnant. And I will never forget the moment. And there was like a few seconds delay because they're learning English fairly well, but it still takes them a little time to process things into their own minds. You could see the moment they fully understood what we were saying. And they literally fell down on the ground prostrate and started shouting all sorts of Jesus and Alleluias. I have no idea what they were saying, but it was like a Pentecostal church service in their kitchen. And they went on to tell us that they had been getting up early every Thursday and fasting all day every Thursday, and praying that God would bless us with a child. And that's my daughter, Zipporah. She's 4 now, but she was about 1 there, with Genevieve and Marie. And she is, I have no doubt, the answer to their prayers. And to ours, but mostly to theirs, because I didn't get up early on Thursdays and fast and pray. So I want to close with that challenge. Practice hospitality. Practice loving strangers. And don't be entirely surprised if a few of them turned out to be angels. Thanks.